Hi, this is Robin of How I See the World, and you are listening to Light on Conspiracies.
Welcome back to Light on Conspiracies, the second part for subscribers only.
I'm here again with my beautiful new friend, Jasmine de Sanguera, who in the first hour told us a lot about the so-called honor, I would call them crimes, against the people, men and women who are being forced to do things that they do not want, such as forced marriages and genital mutilation and so on, done by their own families. And these are things that are happening in countries like the UK as well, not only in foreign countries far away. And Jaswinda, in this second hour, would you mind telling us about, I know that you were involved in a documentary called Honor Diaries.
Yeah.
Would you mind telling us about that experience, who was in it, and what it was all about?
Honor Diaries was a film produced by Paula Kreskin. And the film actually is, for me personally, was an opportunity to come together with other activists across the world. And I remember meeting them in America, where we all came together to hear the dialogues of these women. You know, some of them were from New York, some of them were from Canada, some of them were from Africa, I was from the UK, from all parts of the world. And yet our commonalities were so similar, if not the same, in terms of the struggle, in terms of the challenges we faced, in terms of what we were fighting and advocating for the rights of women and children. And yet we come from so many different parts of the world. And it was absolutely empowering, I have to say, to meet these women, to hear their journeys and to hear about the struggle. Because what unites us are those commonalities between us. And, you know, we shared, and for me personally, meeting other activists who've been on this journey for many years as well, I did not feel so alone. Because I have to say, when you are an activist, and certainly in the first few years, it is a very, very lonely journey. It's a personal journey, especially if you're a survivor, you're giving of yourself every time you speak about the issue, but also in terms of what you are facing, you know, the denial of professionals and communities, the setbacks, people not feeling what you're feeling and acknowledging responsibility, the lack of funds, the lack of resources, you know, the energy it requires. Now, I have three children, and even to this day, they say to me, Mum, you know, there were four people in our family, five people, including me. There were Natasha, Anna, Jordan, Mum, and Carmen Ivana, because it becomes part of your life and your world. So having and hearing this amongst the other women made me feel validation in a way, accepted, to be able to be moved and cry and share in a different way, and energized as well. So the film depicts the experiences of our work in different parts of the world and what we're doing. So I shared the work of the UK, but to hear what was happening in Sierra Leone, for example, you know, and the struggle being the same, but to hear that my sister's struggle is that she doesn't have government support, you know, and it's a question of how can we help her? How can they help me? How can we become a common voice collectively through this film so that we bring it to the attention of the world? And that's what Honor Diaries was about for me personally, and we've maintained our friendships and relationships with each other, you know, and I have to say some of those who took part have had direct risks as a result of it. You know, they've had to remove themselves from raising awareness about the film because people came out and attacked them, you know, verbally. So it's important that we keep on talking about the film and we use it as a tool for people to see what is happening to our fellow sisters across the world. The film depicts, you know, the experience of female genital mutilation, forced marriage, honor abuse, our work, but also the role that the communities play to enforce punishments. You know, you see pictures on there of older men marrying girls as young as 9 years old, and that is acceptable. You know, you see women whose genitalia has been cut completely, and that is seen as tradition. You hear a man speak about how he owns the woman in his house is his property. You know, she cannot leave the house without him. You hear the struggle of the women in Saudi Arabia who are not allowed to drive. So the point I'm making is the film depicts the gender inequality, and it speaks to my experience. And in speaking in a universal voice, we're trying to put this on the international platform.
Who were some of the other women in this documentary?
So I met Raheel Raza from Canada, who I still stay in touch with, and we've met many people. She's an activist in Canada. She speaks out about, you know, your jihad is not my jihad. She speaks out also against extremism and how people are using Islam as a means to abuse women, clearly, you know, and that is not the case. She's a Muslim, you know, and she uses her faith to empower her, you know, and I know Raheel gets a lot of flack, what if you want to call it. She gets attacked verbally. I've been on platforms with her, but you know, she's just so calm in her message and very clear in her message. So, you know, Paula Kweskin, the producer of this, she's a remarkable woman. You know, she took it upon herself to make this film, you know, with very little resources as well. You know, I met a Christian woman who experienced abuse because she was a Christian woman in her community. You know, you saw women from all walks of life that, you know, I remember meeting a woman from Saudi Arabia who is now campaigning for the women in Saudi Arabia because she says, I have my rights. It's important that my fellow sisters have their rights too. So from all walks of life, I met many women. They're the ones that stand out to me.
It sounds like a beautiful experience, I must say. Where can people see this film, Honor Diaries? How can we find them?
Well, the film is, what I impress upon people is use the film as a resource, as a tool to raise awareness. So you can go to the Honor Diaries website, which is honordiaries.com. You can go to their website and you can get a film and host a screening. You know, if there are screenings in the UK, I will go and be on the platform and have a conversation because this is how we break the silences. And certainly some of the other people who are involved in the film will organize. And it says on the website, do you want to organize a screening? Or you can order a film and just, you know, watch it and pass it on to your friends. You know, so again, you can sign up to become a friend of Honor Diaries on the website as well. The point here is that we have to coordinate ourselves collectively to break the silence and to raise awareness. And the film is another tool and a mechanism to do that. Just as other tool, my book, Shame, is another tool. You know, you've read it, pass it on to somebody else. So for me, when I left home, one of the things a survivor tends to do for many years, and I don't do this anymore, is you hope for reconciliation with your family. You miss them terribly. All of a sudden, when you are cast out, there's this huge void, and you spend many days hoping and wishing they would connect with you, give birth to a child, and you think maybe this will change something. You know, I've never had a birthday card for over 30 years from one member of my family. I have three children. For them, on their mother's side, it's a complete blank when it comes to family. So you live with the hope of reconciliation, and I did that for many years until I decided to write the book Shame, because I knew in writing that book that would completely sever all ties with my family. I knew that. But equally, I wanted my truth to be told to the world because this happened to me, but also I wanted to use it as a resource to get people to recognize it can happen to others here in Britain. Again, going back to making the point, this is happening in a civilized, so-called democracy like England. So I wrote the book in 2005, and that was the final straw. My family were very clear that I shouldn't have written the book. I had threat to kill, also from my family. I had hate mail, also from family. And the letters went to people I worked with as well, who were contacting me, saying, your sister sent this letter calling you a liar. And, you know, I remember writing the book. Publishers are quite rightly are concerned about being sued for libel, you know. And mine is a nonfiction book. You know, it's my autobiography. It's my story. And I remember saying I would stand up in any court and defend my truth. And I have to say, some of it was watered down. I couldn't actually give the whole truth in it. So I did my best that I could because of the fear of libel. And I understand that. But I can do that in speaking, wherever I go and I speak. So the book became a bestseller, which for me was remarkable because people were interested in this story. And I remember my editor ringing me and saying, Jasminda, you're a bestseller. And my first response to him was, wow, think about what this is doing for the cause, you know, in terms of the number of people. And then even today, I still get letters from people who've read the book, who pass it on to others. But most importantly, people who say, it helped me to reconcile myself and my identity. It helped me to leave an abusive family. It helped me to realize I'm not the only one. And if a book can do that, you know, that's powerful. And I remember putting it in the hand of the Prime Minister, David Cameron, and saying to him, I would like to give you a copy of my book, but the condition is you have to read it. And he did, he read it. And he said it turned his head. And it's been referred to as a political weapon and credited for criminalising forced marriage. The point here is I have no regrets writing it. And the family are done now, my family, I don't live wanting them to, you know, reconcile with me. And I also have to say that many people who meet me and hear me say, I'm so sorry you haven't got your family, or don't you miss your family? And I say to them with convictions, and I understand that because most people have empathy and compassion, I understand that. I always say, please don't ever pity me. You know, I've let them go. Okay, they disowned me, but I sit here today and I sit with conviction as I get survivors to own this. You have to tell yourself you are owned and you have disowned them, because what you have disowned is that abuse. What you have disowned is not allowing somebody else to treat you less. So, as I said right at the beginning, my honour is their shame. I no longer sit here waiting for them to accept me.
So some of these letters were from your sisters as well?
Yeah. So to my other people, there was an arrest made in my family because there was a threat to kill me and my daughter when the book was published. But, you know, I know this comes with the territory. This is, you know, the Honor Diaries film. You know, I heard all these women, you know, some of them, the threats they've had, it's not just me, it comes with this. If you take a stand against something you believe in and you raise your head above the parapet, be prepared for there to be attacks and as part of that struggle. And this is what more people need to do. I feel safer the more people that talk about this, because I'm not just one individual. There are a number of like-minded people, and that helps you to feel safer. So I can't say I didn't expect that from my family or others. You know, Carmen Ivana's website gets hacked into hundreds of times, by people who are trying to shut us down, shut us up, or discredit us. That's happening all the time. It's happening today.
It's so similar to the things I'm involved in, where it just comes to find out the truth, what is happening, what is actually happening behind this, all of the alleged terror and all of these assassinations and so on. As soon as you start aiming light at these dark forces, they try to hit back in quite a brutal way often. There's quite a few people that are no longer here. But that just shows, or I feel just even stronger, how important it is to do these things.
Yeah, that's a credit to you, because, you know, it angers me sometimes that those in positions of power that can do more don't do more. That's irresponsible. Yes, this is some holidays now here in the UK. There are many thousands of children that are being prepared for marriages abroad. In the 6 weeks holiday, their family will take them out of Britain, force them into engagements and marriages. Some may not come back. England has known this for many years. In one area in Britain, 110 Asian girls aged 15 to 16 went missing from school in one academic year. Nobody asked where those girls had gone. I raised it with the Prime Minister then, and the point I made was this. If 110 white females went missing off our school rolls, this country would be jumping up and down. We didn't ask the same questions of those Asian girls because the attitude was, it's what they do. It's part of their culture. Or we don't want to offend people. And this is still happening. So, you know, in one hand, the education minister could say, every school needs to talk about this. Here in Britain, we have an inspection of schools called the Ofsted inspection. So as I lobbied for a police inspection, we're lobbying for an Ofsted inspection of schools. An inspection will look at many things in a school. And one of the things they look at is, how does that school keep children safe? So it's not just about teaching, it's about how they keep them safe. You know, in the last 3 years, we have been campaigning for the inspection to look out, how does the school prevent forced marriages? How does the school make children aware there are options to keep them safe from being forced into marriages? They haven't done it, but they've managed to get British values on there to teach our children about extremism, terrorism, and British values, but we can't teach them about their rights as a human being to have the right to choose who you want to marry and teach them how to keep themselves safe if they're at risk of a forced marriage. I think it's, and people in power can change that, but people like me and others, we have to struggle to get their attention and get them to recognize that this is what they need to do. And sadly, the months and years it takes us to get them to understand this, in those months and years, many more victims are happening. It's frustrating at times.
You know, the sad thing is that the areas I've been looking into for so many years, I devoted half my life, are so-called terrorism. But to this very day, I have not encountered one real terrorist the way we're being told. I mean, every single time it's state-sponsored terrorism, the enemy within trying to force the population into accepting their agenda. So what I've totally given up on waiting for the government to come with any kind of solution, because they are the problem. They are involved in this whole thing. And I think it's only by individuals like yourself that have the courage to step forward and say, listen, we need to do something. We can't just sit around and wait, because if we wait, nothing will happen. And these problems will just be used as a tool to promote that Islam is equals terror, which is absolutely not true.
But you know, for me, one of the first things they have to accept is that there is even a problem. You know, so here in Britain, when I think about forced marriage and honor abuse, some people are still denying its very existence, or they say it's not a really big problem. Or, you know, the denial in our communities are one of the things they say, oh, it's happening in Pakistani communities over there. My parents were Sikh Indian. This is happening across many communities. So we have to, first and foremost, accept that we have a problem in order to be able to face it and address it and challenge it. You know, when I think about terrorism and forced marriages, they know who the people are in their communities that are doing this. Whether those communities report them or not is another thing. You know, so as I said about the girl Tasleem Begum, she was run over several times until she was murdered. Nobody came forward and said they witnessed that. So the point I'm making is that we have to accept as individuals, as a society, as a government, that we have a problem. And boy, do we have a problem. And then think about who you're talking to, because what I have found in the history of doing this campaigning work is They put forward the community representatives or the religious leaders to represent me and this issue. They don't represent me. I'm not even allowed in that community, so how could they represent me or my fellow brothers and sisters who are affected by this abuse? And this is why within the charity now we have the Survivor Program, which is a huge program to ensure the visibility of people with life experiences, because they're the ones you need to hear. We're launching the website next month, the Survivor Ambassador website, because we need to develop that voice. We need to nurture that voice, and we need their engagement at the table, because they're the ones that can inform policy and practice. They're the ones that have the voice of authority, not my politician where I live or the community leader. They're the ones that need to have a seat at the table.
Do you see this as a spiritual struggle as well?
Yes, in a way. However, you know, when I left home, my parents were Sikh, and I was always brought up to believe that part of the reason why, as women, we had to behave that expected level of behavior to conform, so not to dishonor the family, was because it was part of our religion. That's what we were told. So when I left at 16, I became an atheist, and I basically thought, if that's what this religion does to you, I don't want to do it. Because it was driving me spiritually in terms of my journey, because I had so much hatred, anger, and loss, and, you know, it was everybody's fault, but especially God's fault. Okay, in terms of my life experience and the journey. If you are angry, you internalize that, it's going to eat you up, you know, which is why it's true what they say about forgiveness, is about self-forgiveness first, because you're helping yourself. And then over the years, I do believe that things happen for a reason. I do believe, even you and me talking today, you found me, things will find you. Things, you know, this is a platform, I pray for platforms. Things find you at the right time. The spiritual journey, in terms of my journey with this campaign, has become stronger and stronger. You feel driven by it, if that makes sense. So even going back to the point of my birth, I'm one of seven sisters. I don't regard myself as being special, but I said no. I was the only one born upside down. I was the only one born in a hospital, and my sisters were born at home. From a very young age, my mother would remind me of my difference. And she would instill that in me, which made me different, which made me question things of difference. So in fact, she was doing me a favor, unbeknown to her. So I've almost tuned back into that myself. And my spirituality is so important to me. I mean, I walk in faith. I became a baptized Christian when I was 28. And that was me finding religion, but nobody could force it on me. You know, I did an Alpha program and I learned about it. You know, I did my dissertation in Women in Sikhism. I explored it. I opened to religions and et cetera. And it really was that faith that helped me to rationalize forgiveness and understand it in a different way. I don't go out and evangelize. I don't go out and put it onto anybody, but it's very personal to me and it helps me in terms of my own personal journey. And my spirituality is core to what I do. In all the tables I've sat around, I would say 80% of the people sitting around that table disagree with me. That's how the journey has been. And even today, it's probably about 70 disagree. So you sit there with truth and conviction and, you know, you have this air about you that it's not smug, it's a sense of, when I'm doing what is right and spiritually, it feels okay to me. And if I can put my head on the pillow at night with a clear conscience and feel that, then I'm fine.
Amen to that. I really love the fact that you were born upside down, because I think that has helped you maybe to get a clearer picture of what's going on, because when you see the world today, everything is upside down at the moment. But I would like to go back to the word honor, because I think it's totally misused. And we keep using it as well, you know, we keep repeating it. But this thing, honor, I think there's a total misunderstanding of the value of the word. Because real honor is something I think is absolutely beautiful.
Yeah, the term honor predates the legal system, actually. So if you think about centuries ago, the dueling of two individuals, they were dueling for their honor. That's what they did. So The concept of honor is an individual thing, a personal thing, but then it became about others and how others see you. So the word has been around for a long time, but you're absolutely right. It's being used in a way to justify abuses. The thing here is we have to use the word honor with our victims because it's central to their life experience. So there's no way we can't use it. Hence, you know, we have a definition here in England of what constitutes honor-based abuse. Because the domestic violence definition we have did not speak to our experience. It didn't talk about multiple perpetrators. It didn't talk about the fact that you could be abused for or even killed for being serious in a boy, because that's dishonor. Okay, so the word to explain our life experiences and how it's used and how it is a motivation for use, because you have to remember the perpetrators who commit crimes of dishonor, then they themselves see themselves to be dishonored. So to reclaim that honor, they abuse. They'll force, they want to rectify that. So we use the word honor to describe an experience of a victim, but also to explain a motivation for the abuse. And I don't think you can not use it. So Shafilia Ahmed's case in court here in Britain, the key prosecution witness was her sister. Because if you look at Shafilia Ahmed, she was murdered by her mother and father. All her brothers and sisters were told to watch. So they stood around her, her body was laid on the floor, and a carrier bag was put down her throat and she was suffocated to death. So what the family was saying was this: if you behave as dishonorably as Shafilia, she was just a normal teenager embracing Britain, that this is going to happen to you. If you tell somebody, this is what's going to happen to you. So years down the line, her sister finally broke her silence. So that sister, very brave, will live in protection for the rest of her life, I'm sure. But in court, when she was giving her evidence, she was describing her life, Shafilia's life, according to an honor system. We couldn't do certain things like our friends because it was deemed as dishonorable. The point I'm making is she couldn't describe a life without using that word and the responsibility to that. And the mother and father were convicted. They got 25 years. But by the time you get through the court case and the end of the conviction, you hear a judge talking about how important this word was to the victim. So that's why we use it. But you're absolutely right. We shouldn't say honor killings. I believe we should call them dishonorable killings. But also recognizing that the motivation for the murder was honor related. Our helpline is called the Honor Network Helpline. And these survivors came up with this name, Honor Network Helpline. Why? Because we're reclaiming the word honor. My honor is their shame. I'm reclaiming that word honor. So we can reclaim it for ourselves, and that's what we should be doing.
Are there ever family members that are calling in from sort of the other end of the spectrum, trying to get in communication, trying to persuade you to stop, or trying to understand their daughter that is wanting to stop?
We don't get calls where family members are trying to support their daughter. Sometimes we will get calls from very angry family members who say, we know she rang your helpline, you know where she is, tell us where she is, or we're going to come and find you and we're going to kill you or do something to you. We get those sort of calls. We do get victims calling us, asking us to mediate with their family. Please reach, talk to my mother and father. I'm sure if you explain this is against the law, they'll listen to you, but we would never mediate. We do get family members ringing us and saying, we know she's called your helpline, you know where she is, why can't you talk to her with us and we can sit down and all talk? We do get that. But mainly, we get angry family members who think that we will disclose to them what their daughter or son has said on the helpline, and we wouldn't. So they're trying to track them down, and they try to use us for that reason. And they do that with the police as well. They'll call the police service, and they will say things like, our daughter is missing, when really they're using the police to track the daughter down. And they do that as well. But these are the tactics that they employ.
But you never sit down and mediate between them or any of the organization?
No, absolutely not. If we accept the perpetrators are family, then you wouldn't sit down and mediate with the perpetrator. So if you had a child abuser and the child abuser is the perpetrator, would we sit a victim down with a child abuser to have a conversation and mediate? You wouldn't. So it's the same here. If the family, and it is the family members that they're fleeing, we regard them as perpetrators. So it's important that we do not mediate. And in fact, we have government guidelines nationally laid down by Parliament. And in there, there is a very clear directive that says you must never mediate in the case of a forced marriage. It's very clear. However, many professionals, not Carmen of Honor, will mediate. And then they, all they're doing is they're putting our victims at greater risk. So you have a 17-year-old girl speaking to a teacher or a police officer saying, as Shafilia did, all I want is a bit more freedom. You know, I just don't want to marry a stranger. So then as a Shafilia, the teacher says, well, let's just talk to your mum and dad. Let's all sit down together and let's have a conversation because you just want a little bit more independence, which is exactly what happened with Shafilia. But of course, the perpetrators are going to nod their head in all the right places. They're going to agree. But then what's happened is once that girl goes home and the doors close, you've just increased the risk to her. So you cannot mediate in these cases. The family are not the loving, supportive, protective factor, but they will hide behind that and they will use that to make you look the other way. Just as they will use culture to make you look the other way. Just as they will use race, you know, make you fear that you're offending them. I'm going to accuse you of being a racist. That's to make you look the other way and not take it seriously.
So how do you think your sisters are seeing you now? Do you think they're sort of watching the TED talk you did or these films maybe behind closed doors?
I'm sure they do. It's probably inevitable because I'm on the news and I speak for national news or radio, whatever. And I still go to my hometown in Derby and speak, which is where they live. Some live in London. I'm sure they react and there's certainly no pride, you know, being proud of their sister, because I've not seen that. If anything, I imagine the mindset of calling me names or turning the television off or looking the other way, or I haven't had that for many years since Shame was published. But I always say, if any of them tried anything today, then I would prosecute.
At this point in our conversation, we suddenly got disconnected, and it didn't matter how many times we tried to reconnect, it just didn't want to. So I would like to repeat the free phone number for the helpline. It's 0800-5999-247. 0800-5999-247. And also Jasminda's website, karmanirvana.com. I would like to end with her fabulous TED talk that she performed in Gothenburg. And with that, I hope to see you soon, and that you will join her efforts by signing up and supporting her in any way possible, because these type of human beings are so, so important in the world, and I think we should do everything we can to stand by their side.
Thank you. I would like to thank Ted for the platform. I was somebody who was born in England and I was taught to be silent. I was taught that to speak outside your family or outside your community, you dishonoured your family. So it is a privilege to be here to break the silence of so many people. So I share this platform with all those victims and survivors out there across the world. I would like to start by sharing with you a little bit about who I am, the human being that stands before you today. My father came to England in 1952. Like many migrants, he was invited to England in search of work. He came from rural Punjab. He was a Sikh man. My mother joined him later on in her life, and we were born. I'm one of seven sisters, and I have one brother. The only home I know is England. England is my home. It's the only place I know. We went to British schools in England, and I watched many of my sisters 35 years ago being taken out to British schools to marry men they had only ever met in photographs. They would disappear one by one, and nobody questioned their absences. Nobody asked where they were, and they were flown to India to marry this man in this photograph. In fact, my sister Rubina was 2 years older than me. She returned as somebody's wife and was put back into my year at school. She had a wedding ring on her finger. Her appearance completely changed because she was no longer allowed to wear a Western dress. And yet nobody asked where she had been. I was 14 years old when I came home from school one day, a normal school kid in England, and my mother sat me down and she presented me with a photograph of the man I was to learn, I was promised to, from the age of 8. And I was the one who said no. I remember looking at this picture and thinking, as a 14-year-old girl, he's shorter than me. And then thinking about homework and things. My mother was very matter-of-fact, very jovial. She did this with all my sisters. And by the way, none of my sisters protested. Not one said no. So here was my mother faced with this child of hers who was protesting. And she said to me, I was difficult from birth. I was the only one born in the hospital, the only one born upside down. And so she was expecting this somehow. So I was allowed to go back to school, but the pressure really mounted when I was 15 and a half. Because growing up in England did not actually give me the same life as my peers. We were brought up to believe that we had the power to honour or dishonour our families through our behaviour. So there were certain things that we were not allowed to do as normal adolescents growing up. For example, we were not allowed to go to the school disco. We were not allowed to cut our hair. We were not allowed to wear makeup. We were not allowed to even talk to a boy, let alone date a boy. We had to dress very modestly because all these things were deemed right and proper and honourable. So if we breached any of those codes, and I call them codes because it was conditioning. We were learnt to do this through our behaviour and we were ruled by fear. These were the rules of engagement. And if we breached them, we put ourselves at risk. It could be a trigger for significant harm, physical abuse, a forced marriage, and even though we know today, even murder. So we were very careful. Hence, you hear a lot of these girls living two lives, doing things in secret, away from their family and their community's eyes. When I was 15 and a half, that was when the preparations were happening for my wedding. And I really protested. So my family took me out of education and they held me a prisoner in my own home. And when I mean prisoner, I mean I'm locked in a room and the padlock is on the outside of the door. Somebody's watching the door. I have to knock to go to the bathroom. Food is brought to the door for me to eat. And I was made to stay there until I agreed to the marriage. In the end, I agreed to the marriage purely to buy back my freedom. This was a time for me to plan my escape. And I was expected to take part in the preparation of this marriage. You know, the wedding dress, people come to see the bride. I can only describe it to you as somebody who had a bird's eye view and was looking down, and it happened to be my wedding. I ran away from home when I was 16 years old, in my final year of school, the most important year of school, doing my exams. I ran away over 150 miles from where I lived. I thought it would be safe there. My parents reported me missing to the police, and the police did find me. And here was an officer, 33 years ago, a police officer presented with this young person, begging him not to send her home, pleading him. And thankfully, that police officer gave me the right response. One, he believed me. Two, he did not send me home to mediate with my family and treat me like this strapped little teenager who could actually work this out. Because I can tell you this today as I stand here before you. Had he sent me home, I would be in that marriage. My parents would have presented a different face. Once the door closed, it would have been a very different world. But the officer did tell me to ring home to tell my parents I was safe and well, which is exactly what I did. I'd like to share with you my family's response. And I'd also like to tell you it was my mother and the females in my family who were the key perpetrators, not the men. I'm ashamed to say that women do uphold these honor systems and are the gatekeepers to this abuse. My mother was very clear. She said, you either come home and marry who we say, or from this day forward you are dead. in our eyes, that I had shamed them, I had dishonored them, I had done this to them. So here I was at a crossroads in my life, and I had a choice to make, and it was a choice. I could have gone back home to everything I've ever known, or be on the outside as somebody who was now disowned. I chose the latter. And there are many victims out there who have to make that choice, but what I didn't expect was disownment. It's like me asking you to imagine waking up tomorrow morning and never seeing a member of your family ever again, or never seeing your familiar surroundings and everything you love, and being made to feel it was your fault, because that's how they made me feel. I internalized that as guilt and as shame. I attempted to take my life twice in my teenage years. I felt horrible. Did I love my parents less? Had I done this to them? And I started to live my life, albeit without my family. I had a secret relationship with my sister, Rubina. We would talk in secret. Sometimes disowned human beings have secret relationships with their siblings. And my sister, Rubina, suffered a horrific marriage. And she would tell me how she was being beaten up on a regular basis, psychologically and physically abused. And I would say to her, leave your husband and come and live with me. I will protect you and look after you. And she would say, that's easy for you to say, because you don't have to think about what people think. You don't have to think about honor, which translates as izzet, because she was right. I was disowned. So I begged her to speak to my parents, and she did. She spoke to them, our community leaders were called, and they all did the same thing. They all mediated and talked her into going back to the perpetrator. My sister was 24 years old when she set herself on fire and she committed suicide. For whose honor? And my family's response was this. It was better for her to take her life and not dishonor the family than for her to leave her husband. As a result of her death, I came out of hiding and established a charity called Carmen of Honor. That was established in my front room 20 years ago. And that charity is now a national charity, and it goes on to support victims like Shafilia Ahmed. This young girl was born in Britain. This young girl's crime in life was to have ambition. Her ambition was to be a lawyer. She wanted to be a normal adolescent. All those things you take for granted every single day are the kind of things we can be significantly harmed for. This young girl ran away from home many times. She went to 5 organizations, police, health, teachers, you name them, they were there. And she was telling them, this is happening to me. My family are abusing me because they think I'm too westernized. And if you don't protect me, they will take me abroad and they will force me into a marriage. Shafilia was very clear, and she ran away from home several times, and she was constantly talked into going back home. Because it's cultural, isn't it? It's what we do. You know, it's part of my culture. I can tell you this. Cultural acceptance does not mean accepting the unacceptable. It is not part of my tradition, culture, or religion to abuse anybody. And professionals need to wake up and own that as a fact. I know there are many professionals out there, as I go on my travels, who try to rationalize this. But what they did in her case, not in my case, thankfully, and I'm here to tell the tale, is that they try to sit down and mediate with perpetrators. Because the sad thing is, the people doing this to you are the people who are meant to love you the most. Your parents and your siblings, and your wider community. So in the end, Shafilia went back home after many times of running away and telling people, and she's now on a plane to Pakistan. Her parents drugged her and put her on a plane to Pakistan. She's 16 and a half. And she's on that plane, she goes to Pakistan, and she's presented with a marriage proposal because they wanted to deal with her being too westernized through a forced marriage. And she swallowed half a bottle of bleach in protest. She came back to Britain. She was in one of our hospitals in the UK on a ward for 8 weeks where nobody visited her. And where was she? Where did they return her? The protective agencies, back to her family. Within a few weeks, I can tell you, her mother and father murdered her. She was 17 years old. They held her down and they put a carrier bag down her throat until it disappeared, suffocated her, and her siblings were told to watch. They were convicted last year of 25 years. This is what we call honour killings. We know there is no honour in an honour killing. However, the motivation for the crime is honour related. These are the kind of girls that ring our helpline every single day. I established the Honour Network helpline in 2008. To date, that helpline has received over 30,000 calls just in the UK alone. This is happening to people born in Britain. Please don't think that because I was born in the UK, I have the privilege of independence, of a free mind. That could have been me. And nobody could have told me this at 16. I have three beautiful children. It's the first time I'm sharing their picture here with you all. And nobody could have told me at 16 years old, I was making that decision for the future. As a 16-year-old, what do you know, really? You know, I just didn't want to marry a stranger. But the legacy is important, and we need victims to own, and I'm testimony to that, as are many thousands. You can live your life or be disowned. We know, and I miss my family terribly. I do. You know, I was the only one that graduated at university. I hadn't read a book until I was 27 years old. It's the first time I ever read a book in my life. And I achieved my degree, and I got a first, by the way. And I remember wanting my father to be in the audience, but my father wasn't there. He refused to come. When he died, he left me an executor of his will. So he spoke 1,000 words in his death. I remember for the first time going to my house where I was brought up, opening the door, going into his bedroom, and in the corner of his wall was my graduation picture on the wall. But he couldn't say that when he was alive. And I know that deep within him, he knew what was right. But the power of an honor system is so great that it only exists because people allow it to, not just within our families, but within our communities. When girls like Shafilia are murdered, I don't hear our communities crying out and saying this is wrong. I don't. I put myself at risk, yes, but I fundamentally believe there are thousands out there just like me, like Shafilia, and we need to break that silence because nobody should have to go through with a forced marriage. And we do it, and we do it for the future. My daughter, Natasha, on the far right, when she was growing up, I used to say to her, Natasha, whatever you do, do not marry an Asian boy. And she would say, Mom, you can't say that. That's racist. And I used to say, Natasha, no, you don't marry a boy. You marry a family. The reason I say this to you is because I was her mother. I'd run away from home. I'm twice divorced. I married out of caste. I'm a campaigner. What family is going to accept that? They might take it out on my daughter. And that was my biggest fear. Because one of the things I had to do when I left home and they disowned me, I had to divorce myself from all the wonderful things about my tradition because of the pain. And I miss that. You know, Diwali was this week. It's a Sikh significant festival. You know, I know Sikhism and Islam does not support forced marriage or honor killings. In fact, it supports me. But we miss that culture and that tradition. But I had to do that because of the pain. You can only embrace that if you have people to embrace it with. They are your family. So my daughter goes off to university and she meets an Indian boy. As they do. The children, your children will do the opposite of what you ask them to. And for the first time in my life, here I met a family that did the right thing. That were born in Britain, raised their children here and taught them to be free and independent. I did say to the mother, though, you need to read my book before I meet you, because she needed to understand my experience. And last year, thank you, next slide, my daughter was married. She had the big, fat Indian wedding, okay? And not one of my family were there. But you know what? She had that day because of the decision her mother made when she was 16 years old. She had the right to choose who she wanted to marry. It also challenged me because I can finally put to rest the past. The only time my life was on hold was when I beat myself up every single day for what my family had done to me. When Rabina died, I turned it around and I owned the fact that I was not the bad guy. I was not the perpetrator. They had done this to me. My honour was their shame. So I let them go. I forgave them. And I started to live my life instead of putting it on hold. And my campaign is for you to go out there today and break our silences, please. Because we exist. And we are wanting to believe that even without our families, there is a world out there for us. And you out there believe that this is happening. And it's happening to people who live in a democracy. They do not have the right to an education and independence. The privilege doesn't come being in Britain. Those privileges were not my rights. My rights were taken away from me because I had a family who believed their rights trumped the rights of the country being Britain. Thank you very much for listening to me.
Thank you so much for listening to Light on Conspiracies, the place where truth and love transcend the darkness. Take care and see you soon.
Coup d'etat in slow motion. Connecting the dots between the assassinations of Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme, JFK, Robert Kennedy, and John Lennon. Now available on Amazon and lightonconspiracies.com. Coup d'etat in slow motion.